Begin after six taps. One, two, three, four, five, six.
Hello, and thank you for listening to the FlixWise podcast. Ooh, you. I look just like your host, Lady P. No relation to Master P. Not sure if that worked. We'll see. And joining me today are two ladies who can truly turn the world on with their intellects. In her FlixWise debut is the maven of social media over at Nerdist Industries, Michelle Bushman.
Hey, how's it going?
I keep wanting to say, like, Buckman.
Me
or
too.
Something.
I thought it was Buckman.
So, yeah. Funny story. It's both. It was Buckman, and then my relative ancestors went to Ellis Island, and it was changed to Bushman for
I
some
see.
Reason. I don't know why. It's okay. Not easier. It's harder. But thanks.
Right. Yeah, exactly. Also joining us is the community director over at the Blacklist. Welcome, Kate Hagan.
Hey guys.
thank you both so much for agreeing to come on the show. It should be noted that you both have fancy jobs over at fancy websites, but the reason you're here is because you're both huge classic movie fans, and I believe I met you both at Turner Classic Film Festival.
I think so.
Yeah,
that's correct.
Yeah, bringing people together.
Place to be.
The best film festival.
It's true. It's true. All right, but on today's show, we're doing a FlixWise Favorites episode. I'm very excited about this. Michelle is going to tell us why she thinks Robert Redford's 1980 domestic drama, Ordinary People, is one of the greatest films of all time. I feel like I didn't put enough emphasis on the title. Ordinary People. I guess, like, it's so ordinary. I don't know. Anyway. All right, so Michelle, I'm very curious why you picked this. And why you think it's one of the greatest movies of all time. But first, why don't you give us a little synopsis, and then you can give us the rundown, basically.
Okay, I'm going to give you, like, the Wikipedia synopsis, because I'm really bad at telling people what movies are about. So never, if you see me in person, ask me what a movie is about. It's going to be terrible. But
it's hard, man.
It is really hard to distill something down to a few sentences for me. I'll just ramble and ramble on, and then I feel like I've given away the plot already. So here's the synopsis. Tormented by guilt following the death of his older brother, Buck, in a sailing accident, alienated teenager Conrad Jarrett, played by Timothy Hutton, so good, attempts suicide, returning home following an extended stay in a psychiatric hospital. Conrad tries to deal with his mental anguish and also reconnect with his mother, Beth, Mary Tyler Moore, who has grown cold and angry, and his emotionally wounded father, Calvin, played by Donald Sutherland, with the help of his psychiatrist, Dr. Berger, played by Judd Hirsch. This is probably one of my top five favorite movies.
Okay.
When people hear that, they're like, what is that? Usually, I feel like this movie gets lost a lot. I don't know if I would put it on, like, the Sight and Sound poll, you know, for 250, but it's a movie that I feel like has kind of gotten lost in the last 10, 15 years and is not thought about a lot, and I feel like it deserves a second look, and I think it's more relevant. It just keeps getting, you know, I watch this movie a couple times a year.
Wow.
It's just a movie that I really love the performances in. You know, this movie won Best Picture in 1980. It beat Raging Bull for Best Picture, which is a contentious...
Yes, we will get into that.
...thing for a lot of people. You know, Robert Redford won for directing. He was up against Scorsese, and Timothy Hutton won an Oscar for this. He's the youngest person. He won when he was 20, which is very crazy. This was his first movie. I just love the performances in this movie. It feels like a very relatable movie. It feels very real to me. And I love melodrama. A lot of people kind of scoff at melodrama, and I think it's one of the great things in movie genres is being able to portray melodrama, but doing it well.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely, yeah. Kate, let's start with your reaction. Had you seen this one before?
I thought I had seen this one before. What I had actually seen was about 45 minutes in the second act. So I was rewatching basically from scratch. And I had an interesting experience with this movie, which is that I found myself a little bit bored. Sorry, Michelle.
No, that's totally fine.
In much of the second act, but then I'm sure we'll get into the ending. But to me, the ending of this movie and ending on this kind of very bold, kind of bummer note is really, really interesting and kind of elevated the entire rest of the movie for me. Totally agreeing with Michelle, I think you've got your central trio of Donald Sutherland, Mary Tyler Moore, and Timothy Hutton, who are just stellar in this. And then we've got some nice supporting turns by folks like Elizabeth McGovern, who I love as an unsung actress. I don't know that this movie resonates with me emotionally fully. I really like it, and for me it's kind of a case of the overall effect being less than the sum of its parts, but I do think that the ending on this movie is something that people should really keep in mind when they're trying to end domestic dramas, melodramas, that you can make a bold choice that is not a happy ending, and kind of subverts expectations, and it will only make your story stronger for it.
Yeah, that's something I like about this movie is it's a studio movie, and it is a studio movie about a family that does not end on a happy ending, per se. And I think that's a, you know, something Robert Redford, it's a tribute to him, you know, wanting to not wrap things up tightly. I really, especially in the 80s, with Reagan era everything, I enjoyed that part of the film.
Yeah, I think you bring up a really good point about kind of how critical communities have historically dismissed melodramas, being like, that's for women's pictures, it's overly emotional, like, that's not serious drama. And so I think a lot of the discourse surrounding this movie now is like, I think part of it is just not taken seriously because it does focus on kind of this domestic sphere, right? As opposed to the big macho Raging Bull, right? Like, they couldn't be more opposite. And I wonder, part of why I was so intrigued by the idea of talking about this movie is because we did a podcast on Raging Bull, and all three members of the panel were like, this movie's overrated.
I have an interesting experience with that one, too. Like, I've seen it one time when I was 17 years old, and I have not rewatched it because it's such a good performance from De Niro, but I just, like, didn't fully hook into it. Yeah. And, like, for me, when people talk about Ordinary People now, it's always within the context of, oh my god, that beat Raging Bull for Best Picture. But to me, I'm like, I'm not even worried about that. Elephant Man should have won Best Picture in 1980.
Robert Redford
beat Lynch for the director.
It's wild. I don't understand why this has become one of those movies that, like, snobby people use it as a stick to beat, like, Ordinary People, like, directly. You're like, Have you seen this movie, though? Because it's much lower key.
When I've told people, like, oh, what are your, like, top five? And I throw that in, people are like, really? And I'm like, yeah, sorry. Like, everybody's got different tastes. I just, something with this movie always strikes me.
And that's totally legitimate. I love that, yeah. And people should watch this movie based on its own merits, right? Like, not based off of whatever arbitrary measures that, like... Again, we're talking about, like, this governing body of 1980. The Academy thought that this was the best movie of the year. And it's sort of silly that it has become such a punching bag, right?
It's ridiculous because the movie is so not that. There are so many other movies in the genre that you can throw those kind of, like, sappy sort of over-the-top, like, forced emotional catharsis critiques at, and this movie is not that. I was shocked by how kind of... low energy is not the right word, but how just kind of, like, chill the vibe was in dealing with these mental health scenes and these emotional conversations. I totally expected this, like, big emotional catharsis moment, and when we don't get it, I'm like, oh, that's so much more interesting.
Well, let's, I mostly, my big takeaway from this movie, I remember seeing it several years ago and just feeling like, one, I didn't realize Donald Sutherland was so good looking. I don't know what it was. Like,
one of my first crushes was Timothy Hutton in this movie.
He's cute.
So I get you. But like, also, Donald Sutherland
looking, though.
Did,
I don't know.
Donald Sutherland did Don't Look Now, like, two years before, and then he did this. And I think that's such an interesting 2 years of, yes, of movies.
Yes, there's something like very comforting about his presence, like the dad's, the grandpa sweaters, and
yeah,
just his whole vibe. I was really digging. But ultimately, like, my big takeaway from the movie is just the Mary Tyler Moore performance.
Yeah, she's so good.
She's amazing,
and
right?
Completely and, opposite yeah. from anything else. She's
absolutely
done.
Right. So she's totally playing against type, right?
Yep.
But let's talk about who Mary Tyler Moore is as a public figure, as a persona, and then how she kind of subverts it here, Michelle.
Yeah, I mean, when you think of Mary Tyler Moore, I'm sure you think of the Mary Tyler Moore Show. She's always very bright and sunny. What I love about her in Ordinary People is, yeah, she's the complete opposite. She's very, I've read a couple, like, EW did, for whatever weird reason, like, an oral history of this movie, like, a couple years ago. It must have been an anniversary, because I went, nobody's clamoring for the oral history of Ordinary People, except maybe me. And it was before she had passed, so she was talking about how a lot of people would come up to her and say, like, oh, you're such a bitch in this movie, and she didn't see it like that at all, and I think that's so interesting, is that's what people take away from it. But I think she's just a person who's very set in her ways. Maybe she had a very certain upbringing. She isn't, I don't think she's emotionless. A lot of people think that. I think it's just, she internalizes a lot. And I think her, like, expressions in this role, how she's playing everything very internally, it's just so good and it's so unexpected. And I really love that, without getting into the ending, how her ending kind of shakes out and how it's not, you know, everything's neatly tied up. She's allowed to be a complicated person with a lot of emotions and has to wrestle with those.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, yeah. I don't know. Do we think that it's a sympathetic portrayal of this woman? I guess that's the question that has two parts. Like, is Mary Tyler Moore playing her as a sympathetic character? And then does the movie think she's a sympathetic character?
It's tough. Yes, I think both. I sympathize with her a lot because she is dealing with this crazy event that happened in her life. Her son died. You know, you don't know how to tell what to tell somebody with that, or how do you act in that situation? Everybody would act differently. And I think the movie does a really good job of not saying, hey, you know, shame this woman. She's not having this correct emotional reaction. I think Robert Redford's direction does a really good job at showing everybody different, you know, different shades of grief. And I think that's something I really love about this movie is I have a problem with a lot of mental illness movies. And I think something this movie I really appreciate about it is, oh, there's not one right way to be grieving or what have you, and nobody's a bad person for that. It's just they're trying to get through this thing.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yeah, I always really appreciate films that deal with grief in unexpected ways, and I appreciate movies like this, and a recent example that comes to mind is Manchester by the Sea, that delve into these characters that don't come back from the tragic incident in their lives. They do their best, and you know what? It's just not good enough. Like, they're just too destroyed by this thing that has happened that they ultimately end up making what looks like, on the surface, a selfish choice, but is ultimately a more sympathetic choice to their loved ones, to just remove themselves from the situation rather than to try to pretend that they can go back to a normal that doesn't exist anymore. Yeah, and god damn, Mary Tyler Moore is fabulous in this. I can only imagine going to see this movie in 1980. I totally understand at the time why people would have been like, oh my god, what did you do, Mary Tyler Moore? I hate you now. But I think with the lens of time, we can kind of see that, you know, this is a sympathetic portrayal of this woman who is very set in her ways. And, you know, we don't like to talk about favorite children. She had a favorite child and her favorite child died. And now she's left with a son who she's never connected with. And instead of, you know, having some kind of, you know, oh, I love you, mom, I love you, son, and, like, pretend reconciliation, it's like, you know what? Maybe this isn't going to work for them at this moment in time, and that's okay.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. That's such a bold... Well, we just gave away the ending, but yeah.
No, that's fine.
I mean, that level of nuance, of emotional nuance, is pretty rare in Hollywood films, right?
Especially this was a studio film.
Right, yeah. I mean, this, and especially in the 1980s, which we're kind of on the tail end of the American golden age, right? Yeah. Or like, at this point, it's basically, the winners have been kind of set, right?
Yeah.
Like Steven Spielberg, Martin Scorsese, George Lucas, these people get to make movies, and then they get to, and they're the ones who make money, but something like this, where you have this sort of what we now refer to as a mid-budget kind of prestige. It's an Oscar movie.
Yeah.
Sort of, right?
Kind of, yeah.
Yeah.
And a lot, and it's kind of funny because now I hear a lot, well, mid-budget movies are so rare now.
Mm-hmm.
It's either huge blockbuster or, you know, small indie movie.
Right.
That kind of mid-budget that came out, really flourished a lot in the 80s, is really not so prevalent right now.
Exactly. Yeah.
That's such a bummer to me. Like, 80s mid-budget movies are some of my favorite movies of all time.
Same.
And to just watch that genre die is a huge bummer. And I mean, like, this is an interesting one because to me it feels like you have a lot of movies, I feel like, from the early 80s that still feel like they're 70s golden age, but this, to me, is an interesting example of something that's, like, right on the kind of crossroads of the 70s and the 80s, because you have, you know, these kind of progressive concepts about mental health and taking control of your own life and, you know, taking teenagers seriously, which is something we were just starting to do in the 80s. But then you also have this kind of bummer ending. You have these really complicated emotional relationships that we don't usually get in these kind of family studio movies. So this is a really interesting in-between point for those two kind of decades to me.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely, yeah. I will say, I think there is a distinction to be made between something like Ordinary People and something like Elephant Man, which I don't know what exactly that distinction is. I don't know if I can put my finger on it because they're both highly emotional, right?
You know, like, it when you see it,
but it's
tough to convey into words.
And
just talk about just radically different. I was looking at the 1980 Oscars, and just, God, we used to nominate so many more interesting movies for Oscars. Like, what was 80? It was Raging Bull, Tess, The Elephant Man, Ordinary
People.
Coal Miner's Daughter. You're like, what an interesting crop of Best Picture nominees. I would die for a list that interesting now.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Although, and maybe we'll look back in 20 years and think that, like, we had another golden age, right?
Yeah.
I think the whole, this is a whole separate conversation, but I think the whole, like, 10 nominee thing is totally cheating. And
it's crazy.
It's dilutes
the
thinning
list,
it's watering down.
Yeah, exactly.
But,
yeah. But anyway, but yeah, how do you think this became the kind of mode that Hollywood started, like, seeing as the prestige movie? And then how did we become so resentful of that mode? I don't know. It's a difficult thing to kind of trace. And I don't know that there's a specific instigating moment. But I think that there is something specific about Ordinary People that
it's definitely, if you watch it now without context, you'd be like, this is an Oscar baiting movie.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, at the time, it didn't seem like that, I'm sure. It was probably, you know, it's also like the whole studio system now is like, well, okay, it's fall, what are our Oscar movies? You know, we have to make this thing for this. It's almost like filling a quota.
Mm-hmm.
It doesn't feel like that movie to me, but it's interesting how maybe that was the start of it, or, you know, these quiet family dramas kind of became in fashion. That seems like something in the 80s that really started to turn into that.
What are some other, I guess maybe we're kind of dancing around the question, what are we talking about here? What are some other, I should have a better answer for this, but like, the only movie that comes to mind is, like, incredibly loud and Something Close. Do you remember that movie?
Oh, yeah.
Something Loud and Close. Like, that to me, it was the nadir of this whole thing, where it's like you make a very emotional, kind of important-seeming movie, and immediately you get nominated for an Oscar, regardless of whether of the movie's quality or not, right? Like, it has all the dressing of a of a prestige movie, and yet it actually isn't that good. And is there actually a distinction? Like, maybe it is. Maybe we've been all just too dismissive and we're tired of this trend. I know I'm taking our topic about ordinary people and turning it into, like,
I think it's interesting. I think you can make these movies, but they have to have substance to them. They can't be empty. And I think audiences are getting smarter. Well, hopefully audiences are getting smarter, too. Oh, well, this is the prestige picture, you know. This kid died or blah, blah, blah. It's filling that plot quota as opposed to a movie that's, you know, a small family drama, character drama, melodrama, but it's doing it well and it knows what it is. And I think that's important to have that distinction of sometimes there are movies on both sides like that.
Mm-hmm.
Absolutely. It's like we were talking about, you know it when you see it. And that's definitely something, I mean, like, I don't know, something just to use an example, I was just talking about, like, Manchester by the Sea, which on its face looks like another just, like, dude weeper, but then is actually about some really complex ideas about grief. I'm so curious with Ordinary People specifically, too, if it became kind of the jumping off point for this idea of the prestige movie because it was beat by Raging Bull, which was considered an art film at the time, and beat The Elephant Man, and this is so not that. It's so popular entertainment, and, like, that becomes sort of, I don't know, I was just trying to, like, do a mental scan. I was thinking maybe, like, Forrest Gump being one of the points at which, like, the idea of a prestige movie, because talk about something that just, like, checks every Oscar box. Yeah. And you can kind of look at, like, the ensuing Oscar races from that, whereas pre-Forrest Gump, you know, you'd have these kind of prestige movies, but then you'd have things like, I don't know, like Howard's End or something getting in, where it's like, yeah, it's a prestige movie, but it's also not really trying to be that. It just happens to be. It's interesting because definitely it is epidemic now. I mean, there are just like a dozen movies every year that you look at and you're like, oh, they made this for Oscars. And here's the point at which a character's loved one dies. Right. And here's the emotional catharsis beat. And
Yeah, totally. Except now it's always like period drama.
Right? Yeah.
Like that's what's in
biopics.
Now. Biopics, exactly. But yeah, we'll see if there's room for films of this subject matter, like Lady Bird, obviously not the same, but very popular.
I would say share some DNA in terms of just like low-key family drama. Here's a family, obviously very different themes, but just in terms of taking a teenage protagonist seriously and treating them like they would treat, you know, a celebrated thespian in a lead role.
That's a good point. Speaking of taking teenagers seriously, let's talk about Timothy Hutton.
I love him in this movie so much. Things that, like, blow my mind are he did this when he was 19. His dad had just died, right before he made this movie, which is crazy, and maybe that changes how I look at it a little bit. But I just think it feels very real and grounded to me, and, like, everything is in his eyes sometimes, or his facial expressions, and it's not, like, a caricature of, oh, you know, somebody who tried to kill themselves or whatever. It feels very real and honest, and he's not trying to be a stereotype of that, which you can, it's so hard with movies about mental illness to fall into that trope, kind of. And I think he just does such a good job of it. I mean, that's, you know, if he wasn't doing a good job, this movie wouldn't carry anything.
Sure, yeah, absolutely.
Yeah, he's so fabulous, and I was really surprised by the vibe of the therapy scenes in this, which I had seen before, but seeing the entire film in context, I mean, it just kind of, like, so underlines how hokey something like Good Will Hunting is.
Yeah. Thank you.
Yeah, and when you see something like this where it's done really well, and, you know, in 1980, the idea of voluntary therapy is still so off-putting for not only the characters in the movie, but general audiences, to have it treated as this just, like, the therapist is not going to give you all the answers, the therapist is not going to fix you, but the therapist is going to make you question yourself and hopefully come to some realizations on your own that can be really powerful. And, like, I would say that's the biggest bit of emotional catharsis we get in the film is their relationship and how that evolves. And obviously Judd Hirsch is just the best.
He's so good in this.
And Alex Rieger, I love you.
He does such a good job of not being a stereotype psychiatrist. And I, especially, you know, somebody who's been in therapy for a while, like, it's very easy to write and make it seem like, oh, well, Good Will Hunting. Oh, it's not your fault. Blah, blah, blah. These are the keys you need to live. That's not how life works. And I really love that they don't get, he doesn't go that route. And it's about, you know, helping him realize these things. Or, you know, I love, you know, Timothy Hutton comes in the first time. He's like, oh, I really want more control in life. And he kind of helps him realize, well, like, no, that's, you know, it's part of more underlying things. But he's not there to, you know, I'm not there to, like, instantly fix you. And I really love that, especially in 1980, that was, like, a really radical thing at that time.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. The Good Will Hunting thing reminds me that our previous FlixBuzz favorites entry was Titanic. another maligned Best Picture winner. And people think, I think a lot of people, I know, not by us, hopefully.
I like Titanic. Okay. Yeah,
I saw
Titanic 3 times.
Perfect.
That's a whole separate conversation
Titanic Redux.
I went through a phase as a teenager where I was very fascinated with Titanic history, so like that's my jam. It's just that right amount of like melodrama romance, but history, and being a history nerd.
Oh, so good.
I think Titanic might be the single most appealing movie ever made.
I am so here for that opinion.
I love it. I like don't give a fuck if people don't like it. If you can write a line as good as You Jump, I Jump, like, get back
there
to me.
There is no line better than You Jump I. I sincerely
I'm glad we're all on the same page.
I hope you all go and listen to the podcast. I feel like, for more, see our previous episode. But it does occur to me that, like, Good Will Hunting is often cited as the robbed party of that year.
Whatever, right? Man.
Yeah.
No.
Yeah.
So, 97. So
yeah, right?
I mean, my movie I love from that year that no one has seen is The Sweet Hereafter, which is another movie about grief and is a very unconventional look at grief and how we deal with the aftermath of tragedy. But that movie's been totally lost to the sands of time.
Yeah, it's so funny, again, just how arbitrary these, like, I almost think it's like fanboy whims, right? Mm-hmm. Like, the Scorsese stans are like, can you stand for Scorsese? I feel like that's
100%.
Yeah, yeah. Okay. But I think they're upset, and like, it just all feels like when people on the internet feel slighted, they get real upset.
Yeah.
They do.
Yeah, yeah. And maybe it's not just an internet thing. I think it's just like these ideas spread, and then something gets lost in the discussion, right?
Yeah.
Good Will Hunting, I personally think, is kind of a cheap imitation of Ordinary People.
That's what I was thinking watching this. Model. Yeah.
And I'm from Boston, so that's a movie where, like, when that came out, it was everywhere, Good Will Hunting, and you had to like it. Oh my god, it's hometown. Why aren't you... It's fine. I don't think it holds up very well years later. Mm-hmm. There's a lot of stuff that bothers me about it.
Yeah.
It's fine, but I've read in a bunch of places that they were trying to model the therapy scenes in that movie after the ones in this, and I'm like, no, man, it's not as good. It feels so much more stereotyped, and that relationship doesn't feel as, you know, wonderful and free-flowing, and I don't know. It's just, like, a subpar.
Yeah. It's also just much more central to the plot of the movie, right? Like, this, everything happens in the shrink's office there, right? Whereas... Yeah. In Ordinary People, it is like one of the steps he takes in order to get better, but like we have a broader focus.
There's
on
so many other
like,
more things
yeah,
going on.
Exactly,
yeah,
exactly. Yeah. So I think some of the beats are similar. Like I think their relationship is similar. And I don't know, like no relationship. I've never had a relationship with a shrink that looks like that. So I don't know that I can speak to its verisimilitude, like, or how authentic it feels. They do have kind of, like, a sweet buddy kind of relationship. The Judge Hirsch character, he strikes me as, like, somewhat inauthentic in a very kind of... He seems like a movie character, frankly.
But I do like that relationship.
I appreciate the distance in that relationship. I feel like so many movies with therapists try to be like, we're best friends, you're my substitute mother, father, husband, wife, etc. But this movie, we're very clear that there is a hierarchy, that this is a professional relationship, that Timothy Hutton goes to this man in a professional capacity, but he's not gonna, like, you know, show up at Timothy Hutton's swim meet and make it all better.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And I really appreciate that about this movie, that it keeps that kind of arm's length distance that I think makes the therapy work resonate much deeper than, you know, something like Good Will Hunting, where it's like, I've solved all your problems.
Oh, I hate that so much.
Okay, all right, enough ragging on Good Will Hunting. But it's so fun. Apologies to anyone who wanted to submit Good Will Hunting for the FlixWise favorites list. I'm going to say that's going to be an uphill battle. okay, but I guess let's talk about style and just, like, the formal qualities of the movie. And I think this is likely the biggest reason why people are so skeptical of the film, right? Like, it doesn't have any kind of authorial presence, really, or at least no really distinct authorial presence. So, but are there moments, like, specific shots in the film that really resonate with you on, like, any kind of aesthetic level?
Yeah, I mean, I think just, oh man, that whole last dining table scene with how Donald Sutherland is shot, I really love, which was a reshoot, by the way. I read a story where the first take of that, Redford was in the editing room and Sutherland didn't like how he looked on it. He was crying too much and he was like, can we reshoot? And Mary Tyler Moore was in New York doing theater work, so it's Robert Redford off scene reading her lines to him doing it, and it was like a very last minute reshoot, which when I watch the scene now, I'm like, oh my god, like, how did you just tap into that again? That, like, breaks my heart. A lot of, like, the close-ups with Timothy Hutton, just the expression, it's more the performances in this film than the visuals, but I think that's very deliberate by Robert Redford. He's not trying to be splashy and, you know, glamorous. And I think it serves the material better that he isn't.
I have to say that I would say the directing and some of the pacing is the weakest aspect of this movie for me. For me, this movie could be 20 minutes shorter and still be just as effective. And I do sort of miss that kind of deliberate, not that Redford is not making deliberate choices as a director. Of course he is. Of course he's doing things to elicit performances and get the shots he wants to shoot. But there's just something about it that feels a little bit anonymous, that, like, any other person that was working with those kind of films could have made this movie at this time. And, you know, it's interesting to talk about Redford in the context of the Academy loves to award actors who direct films and make that pivot. And I would imagine that some of the resentment around this film stems from that as well. But yeah, I would say one of the directorial choices, and whether this can be attributed to Redford or location scouts, is I would say the way the film captures the very bougie suburbs of Chicago is dead on. It's so right. And just what that milieu looks like, and the kind of, you know, expectations of that world, and obviously Mary Tyler Moore's character is dealing with that a lot. But that feels very authentic to me, and you know, it's weird. It's like the pacing doesn't work for me, but I like a lot of the subplots. Like, I especially think the subplot with Timothy Hutton's friend Karen, who ultimately commits suicide after he has that, like, very cheerful meeting with her, is really compelling and really, really resonates, because you're like, oh my god, this has a very real consequence, and, you know, in a different movie, it would be like, he'd race to save her at the last moment, but, like, we're not doing that here. Mm-hmm. Like, it's just sad.
Yeah. And he has to deal with it. I like that.
Yeah,
I would agree. I think, if anything, the weakest part of this movie is the directing, and I do. When people are like, oh, but you love this movie, what about Robert Redford? I'm like, look, I'm not gonna defend that. Like, the Academy voted on it. I don't agree, but again, yeah, they love to award directors turned actors, for sure. Yeah. I mean, actors turned directors, for sure.
Yeah. And he's since gone on to make a handful of other movies.
Yeah, I was thinking about, it's like a River Runs
His filmography as a director is so fascinating to look at. Yeah. It's so weird.
Did he direct Up Close and Personal,
I think he did. Yeah. And, well, and Legend of Bagger Vance.
Oh, yeah, I forgot about that movie.
Speaking of Matt Damon.
What a strange amount of choices, yeah. You know?
Yeah. Interesting guy.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, you have all this power to make whatever you want.
Yeah,
right?
And like that's what he wanted to make.
It was Bagger Vance, man.
Yeah, he just really wanted to tell a story about a magical golfer or golf caddy.
I think in terms of style, it's more whittles down to, like, I have very specific scenes that I really love in this movie more than anything else, and they just work for me.
Sure. Yeah. That's totally fair. All right. Well, is there any other points we wanted to bring up?
Can we just talk about how good Donald Sutherland in this is? Because I feel like we didn't. He's just so great.
But he's crazy unsung, too, in terms of consistency and just elevating everything he's ever been in. Like, can't miss, man.
Yeah. He's so good. And I get sad because now he's kind of relegated to, like, the older grandfather figure or, like, I mean, he was in The Hunger Games.
Yeah.
Which is so bizarre. He does these strange, varied roles. But, like, man, when he was, like, at his peak, he was so good.
Mm-hmm.
Same with, like, Timothy Hutton isn't in anything anymore.
Yeah, I wonder what happened to him. Like,
he's in all the money in the world, looking very old. Okay.
He has aged. Like, if you look at him now versus ordinary people, I'm like, oh, man, you really age. Not that that's a bad thing.
Happens to the best of us.
Yeah. You know, talk about, like, somebody who you're like, oh, his career must have blown up after that. He does a lot of TV now.
Yeah.
I feel like that's such a curse when folks win Oscars at a young age.
Yeah.
I mean, you have people like Anna Paquin who've kind of transcended it, but so often, I mean, look at, like, Tatum O'Neill's career and how, I mean, obviously she had other issues to contend with.
Yeah.
But that sort of, like, youthful victory, I think for something like this, I'm sure it was hard for Timothy Hutton to be seen as anybody besides that character for many years.
No. I'm sure.
Yeah.
I don't. Like I was saying before, I'm not saying this is one of the best movies of all time. It's just like a movie that tends to resonate with me.
Okay. All right. I think that's totally fair. Yeah.
I definitely think it deserves a second look, even being not as into it as Michelle and like finding some flaws in it. Like, I don't know. It's just so different than the way people talk about it, which happens so often with classic movies. You have this perception of what the movie is going to be like, and then you see it, and you're like, well, it's super not that. And just, you know, I think the key here is performances, and if we do have to praise Redford for something as a director, I think it's creating and crafting those performances, even if the film style leaves a little something to be desired, to get, you know, I thought that golf course fight between Donald Sutherland and Mary Tyler Moore, it was just like absolutely aces.
Felt so real.
No, the tightrope that this movie walks in terms of both people being right, both people being wrong in any given situation is really impressive, and you know, we miss so much of that kind of emotional nuance, I feel like, in these kind of movies now.
I think to tie it all in, the ending is really what I love about this movie, is like, hey, you know what, the spoiler alert, it doesn't end on a happy note. Like, Mary Tyler Moore leaves, and Donald Sutherland and his son are there at the end. You know, it's kind of open-ended, and what do they do next? You don't know. I really love that. I love that it's a studio movie that did that. I think that's a really a path that a lot of films have tried to do going forward. Really strong writing, I think, in sections of this film. Absolutely. I don't think it's a perfect movie, but it, like I said, it has sections that are really strong.
Okay, yeah. In previous podcasts, we've talked about how the 90s were actually a really great era.
Amazing.
For this type of movie, right? And it didn't have the kind of pretensions of an important movie. You could just make a good movie that people wanted to watch, right?
Yeah. Like, well, there was so much cash flowing in indie film to be able to do that.
Exactly. Yeah. So, it does kind of harken back to that, but even earlier, it makes it all the more impressive, right? Like in the era of Return of the Jedi, or Raiders of the Lost Ark was 1980, right? Like this was the alternative. Like this is the opposite of Raiders of the Lost Ark, right? I will second everything that you guys said. Like, I think it's certainly worth revisiting, even if it's not a perfect movie. But
I don't know. I haven't really laid out any parameters or any kind of rubric for things getting in the FlixWise favorites list. But it sounds like maybe this isn't necessarily a contender, you know, but I think it's like, I mean, we can yeah. certainly, we can discuss.
When people ask me what's a underrated movie, I yeah. usually say Ordinary People, because yeah. mm-hmm. I think it gets forgotten a lot. And I would put it in the, you probably forgot that this was a movie.
Yeah.
But it's worth watching.
Sure. Yeah.
So many of, like, we brought up Coal Miner's Daughter earlier. Like, to me, that's an absolutely incredible biopic and, like, sets the bar so high. And, like, nobody talks yeah. about a movie like yeah. that anymore. And it's just fabulous.
Yeah.
And it's, I just miss so many of these stories about people living lives, yep. man.
Yeah. yeah. I love sad movies. It's just a thing with me, like... People are like, oh, well, that must bum you out all the time. No, I actually really enjoy watching yeah. like melodrama and that sure, kind of stuff.
Yeah.
It's cathartic.
Yeah.
But we don't see a lot of them built like this yeah. anymore.
Mm-hmm. No, I get really stoked when a movie makes me cry because I'm like, yeah. Maybe I'm not all the way dead inside.
Yeah, exactly.
Incredible.
Yeah. yeah. exactly. I mean, and with kind of, I think people are starting to revisit melodramas from the 50s, right?
Yeah.
So, like,
yeah.
maybe
was it,
this will...
Metrograph just did the melodrama mm-hmm. series? That made me really happy. I was like, yes, finally, we're like, bringing it into the conversation.
Yes, yes. And so maybe one day...
Yeah.
We will revisit this and look back and say, like, well, maybe this was, in fact, the one of the best movies of the 80s or whatever. And I like honestly think Elephant Man is a total melodrama.
Oh yeah, yeah.
Oh
sure.
yeah. Talk about just like, oh, they talk about a movie that makes me cry. Yeah, to, like, yeah. An oh my god. Yeah. yeah.
If we've come to one decision at this episode of this podcast, it's melodrama. It's not a dirty word.
Yeah,
that's
man.
All I
Absolutely.
Want, man. Bring it back.
Absolutely,
I'm
here.
In for it.
I love it. And that's the way we frame it, FlixWise. That is, listeners. Do you think the Academy got it right when it awarded Ordinary People the Best Picture Oscar? Come let us know on our website, flixwise.com, or you can leave us a note on our Facebook page, facebook.com/flixwise. And if you want to come talk to me about Donald Sutherland's sweater game, then you should probably follow me on Twitter. The handle is @flixwise. But before you do all of that, please, please go to iTunes or your podcatcher of choice. Subscribe, rate us, and leave us a nice comment, if you please. And if you have a suggestion for the FlixWise Favorites list, you can tweet at me, or you can drop me an email, info@flixwise.com. I know our last two entries involve seafaring, this one and Titanic, but boats needn't be involved, necessarily. Though, frankly, it couldn't hurt, right?
Boats-wise.
Yeah, yeah, exactly.
Boats-wise. Until then, Michelle, thank you for bringing this to our attention and offering up Ordinary People to the list.
Thank you for accepting it.
Yes.
Totally.
Yeah. And Kate, thanks for agreeing to watch such bleak programming.
Yeah. I love it, man.
Yeah.
Sign me up.
You just feeling like stuff? All the feels.
Kitchen
yeah.
sink dramas laid on me, baby.
Yeah. There we go. All right. Okay. So, would you both consider coming on again?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah? For sure.
All right. Then, in that case, I think we're going to make it after all. Let's all throw up our hats.
We did, guys. You just didn't see it.
Yeah, exactly. I always live every day like Mary Tyler Moore.
Yes.
R.I.P. Mary Tyler Moore, the goddess.
Yeah.
Thanks for everything you gave us.
Yeah.
yeah.